WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. My name is Kevin Tachi. I will be here with you for the next 2 hours as we sit and we talk about local things, things that are going on here on the South Shore and up at the State House. We are going to get right into our conversations. Actually, our first guest, State Senator John Keenan, is on hold. He's waiting to chat with us in just a moment, but just a quick rundown as to who our guests are for the remainder of the show. So happens we will speak with a couple of local representatives. We'll start with in the town of Hanson. We will speak with Laura Fitzgerald Kemet. She is the chair of the Board of Selectmen, and we'll get caught up as to what's going on in the community. And she gives us a little bit of a rundown since the last time we talked with her. I think we had a conversation just prior to town meeting, and so we'll get caught up as to what's going on there. Hour number two, we kick things off. We'll speak with Justin Evans. Justin is a member of the Whitman Board of Selectmen, and we'll have an opportunity to get a little bit of a scoop from him regarding not only what's going on in the community, but the recent news about the sale of Peaceful Meadows. If you are somebody who is, you love ice cream, there are many spots around the South Shore, and I'm sure there's several folks who are tuned in right now who would probably name off Peaceful Meadows in Whitman as one of those places that you must stop and grab, you know, your favorite selection of ice cream. Well, news has come out that, in fact, they are going to sell that property. It's going to be up for auction. We will speak with Justin to see what the town has learned in recent days since this was announced, and if maybe the town of Whitman might be a player in purchasing that property. We'll close things out with our legal beagle. His name is Chris DiOrio, and we'll get an update. It's just a little bit more than a year since Roe versus Wade was overturned. We'll have a chance to speak with Chris about that and a few other things. So that's coming up. But right now, we turn our focus to State Senator John Keenan, who is a regular guest who's on here. Senator, how is your summer going so far?
Quickly, but otherwise it's going pretty well.
I couldn't have said it any better. It's like, honestly, it seems like yesterday was the middle of June, and I'm like, what can I do to be productive and take care of essential things, but yet do it in a relaxing way? And here we are, there's a week left in July. I can't believe it.
It went by so quickly. Really incredible.
Yeah, so, you know, I want to make sure that I gave you an opportunity. Recently, there was a media piece in regards to a piece of legislation. And it was an interesting piece because the package spoke to the revenge porn bill, and that of all the states that have such a law in the book, Massachusetts is one of the few that do not have this piece of legislation. If you could, and I think you've done it previously, but just to remind folks, what exactly is this piece of legislation in regards to revenge porn?
Sure. So if somebody in Massachusetts consents to have an image taken of them, and then that image is shared on social media or in any other way, the sharing of that image without consent is legal in Massachusetts. So somebody could say, take a picture of me in this situation, but don't do anything with it. And then the person who took the picture disseminates it over social media, for instance. That dissemination is not illegal. Massachusetts is one of two states where that is the case. And so this legislation would look to address that issue by closing that gap and making sure that if you are going to post something online, for instance, that you have to have the consent of the person who's depicted in that posting if it comes to nude images and things like that.
So what would be the, if in fact the individual did not have consent, what would be enacted in this legislation?
This would make it illegal by basically then putting in place penalties for it. The first offense would be imprisonment in the House of Correction for not more than 2.5 years, by a fine of not more than $10,000, or by a combination of fine and imprisonment. And then there is a penalty for a second or subsequent offense, and that would be a longer prison term and a greater fine. But we're sensitive to that, to the idea that not every case arises to the level where there should be criminal punishment for it, particularly when it comes to young people. And so the bill also contains provisions that one would set up an educational program that could be used in the schools to advise and teach young people about the dangers of online sharing of indecent visual depictions. And in the case that if there is a situation where it has been shared and it's a young person and it appears that something other than incarceration would be in order, there is a diversion program and a further educational program that would be available to that young person. So we're really trying to strike the balance between somebody who may make a youthful mistake, there may be a youthful indiscretion, but we acknowledge the harm of that can be quite severe. But the idea would be to educate in that case. But we clearly acknowledge that there are some outrageous, egregious cases that do deserve criminal punishment. And right now, that's not available in Massachusetts.
Now, was this the first time that you have filed this legislation, or is this one of a number of times that this has been filed?
It was filed in the House last session and passed the House of Representatives unanimously. It did not have a Senate counterpart. When it came over to the Senate, I took it under, put it into the bucket of bills that we worked on, and we were able to get it passed in the Senate near the end of the session. There were some slight differences between the House version of the bill and the Senate version of the bill. Given the short period of time at the end of the session that was available, those differences, the bill was not sent to a conference committee to iron out those differences. So it's been refiled, and we're hopeful that it will move this fall in both the House and the Senate.
And do you feel that you have sufficient? I mean, you've already mentioned that it overwhelmingly passed in the House. So now it's a matter of it getting through the Senate and then getting to conference committee. Am I correct?
Yes. And again, it did pass the Senate, and it passed the Senate on a voice vote. There wasn't a roll call vote on it. But I believe if there were to be a roll call vote on it, that it would pass the Senate. And so our goal is to get a public hearing on the bill, which is part of our legislative process, to have that hearing as early in the fall as possible, and then to really put some movement into the bill so that we can pass it and get it to the governor's desk before the flurry of bills that occurs starting in January of next year.
And are you hopeful that this will all happen? And if it does have to go to a conference committee, are there vast differences between the House and the Senate version, or are they pretty much similar?
They're very similar. In fact, since last session, when the House had passed this, the Senate had passed this, and there were differences, Representative Jeff Arroyo Franklin, who's really been a champion on this, he and I have been in conversations. There's no doubt in my mind, no doubt in his mind, that we'll be able to work out the differences very quickly and then move it to the governor's desk. So it's really just getting it through the hearing process and then getting it before the bodies. And I think if a roll call vote is taken on this in the state Senate, it will pass. Again, we're only one of two states that hasn't passed this yet.
Do you look at legislation like this and wonder if it's a sad state of affairs that we have to enact or put forth a bill like this to protect people because someone would be willing to, show a piece of footage that is, maybe not unflattering and not something that was meant for public consumption?
It is very disheartening. It's very sad that that occurs. Some of the stories that have been shared with me are heartbreaking. And seeing what people go through, the victims go through, it's really, really terrible. And I don't know, I guess some people think that just putting an image on social media isn't a big deal. But when you take a look at the impact on those that are shown in the image, it is devastating. And on the segment that was aired on local television, Alex Hegarty from the town of Abington, the select board there, shared his story. And I thank him so much because it has been very impactful. And people at the State House clearly saw that and are talking about that and getting a greater sense of the urgency of this bill. And so I thank him for his courage in doing that. And there are others who have shared their stories with me that they're just heartbreaking. And what the victim goes through and what the family of the victims go through, and then knowing that there really isn't any way to address it under our current laws, it is sad. It's disheartening. It's not right. And that's why we're really pushing this legislation.
Again, if you're just tuning in, you are tuned into Monday Night Talk, and we are speaking with State Senator John Keenan as part of the State House report. We try to do this on a weekly basis, touching base with our local state reps and state senators to find out some of the things that are going on up at the State House. Another piece of legislation I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about. You have long, and I've said this before, long been a champion of when it comes to our health, whether it's, you know, nicotine or drugs or health provisions. Can we talk a little bit about your mental health bill and what this would bring forth? I believe it's like a 30-day. The legislation deals with 30 days worth of medical attention for an individual. Am I correct?
Yeah, so we've got a few bills that deal with mental health and substance use. So one of the bills that we've worked on through a few sessions, is Senate 662, which is an act providing access to full spectrum addiction treatment services. And by full spectrum, we mean beyond what they call kind of step-down treatment. So somebody will go through detox, and then they will go to the next level of treatment, and that next level of treatment may last up to about 2 weeks. That is, under state law, required to be covered by insurance companies. So about 14 days of coverage, including detox and step-down treatment, is covered. What we know is that it takes a lot longer for the benefits of recovery to really show themselves. And so this bill would extend that 14 days to 30 days, because most of our inpatient treatment programs, and outpatient treatments are even longer, but most of our inpatient treatment programs are above 30 days. And so this would ensure that insurance companies have to provide coverage for those who are inpatient, in recovery, and receiving treatment. And we're hopeful that this bill will pass as well. The need for it is great. We know that somebody with 14 days of treatment, if they are released from treatment, are at a greater risk at that point of an overdose, because their tolerance for a drug is down, and yet the treatment isn't complete, so they're at a higher risk of relapsing and using the same amount of drugs that they may have used 2 or 3 weeks before, and putting themselves in a situation, again, where they're at a heightened risk of overdose. So we're working on that. We're also working on a bill that would, on the mental health side, make sure that insurance companies provide continuity of coverage. Last session, we were successful in getting a continuity of coverage bill passed for those who have MS. They go through a process of finding what medication works best for them. And then we found that if there was a change in their employment that resulted in a change in their insurance coverage, or if their employer switched insurers, that the new insurance company might not cover that medication and might make them go through a process to find another medication. And that's devastating for somebody on MS. We're finding the same thing on the mental health side, where somebody finds a counselor, which is very difficult to do, establishes a relationship with that counselor, a patient and clinician relationship, and is making progress. When there's a change of insurance or insurance company decides not to cover that, the results can be devastating. So we're looking to make sure that if somebody has found a counselor, that coverage for that treatment will continue regardless of changes in their insurance, and that their co-pays and things like that will remain in place, so that there's nothing to prevent them from continuing on with that critical treatment. And with everything we see and hear about the needs in the community for mental health treatment, this is a very important piece of legislation, and we're optimistic that this will move in some form or other as well.
This sounds more like a loopholes piece of legislation, especially when it comes to insurance coverage.
It is, because it's something that's, you know, unless somebody has experienced it, they're really not aware of it. If you have insurance in place and it continues, this is not an issue. But given the way the workforce has changed, people are changing jobs more frequently, insurance companies are always looking to save cost, this legislation is needed now is more than it's ever been.
You know, here we are, you know, there's a week left in the month of July, something we kind of just, we touched upon as we opened up and marveled at the summer's going so fast. But also going so fast is the amount of time for the fiscal year 24 budget to make its way out of conference committee and get voted on by each, you know, part, you know, with the House, the Senate, and then go to the governor's desk. What are you hearing at this late hour as to where things stand? Because I'm trying to think as to when was the last time we went so deep into the month of July that it had not yet found its way out of conference committee for a vote and then some action taken by the governor.
It's been a while since we've been this deep in July without any real sense of when it will emerge from the conference committee. In 2020, with COVID, we went several months because of just the uncertainty of federal assistance and all of that. But this, kind of in the normal cycle, is, you know, it's getting quite late. And there are some pretty significant things that have to be resolved. One of them is the determination of how much money the Commonwealth has to spend on this budget. The House of Representatives passed a tax relief proposal or bill, and the Senate passed a tax relief bill. And there are differences in those two bills. And so before the budget can be done, there has to be some sort of agreement on how much money each branch feels is available to fund a budget. And recent estimates are that the Senate projection as to the cost of its tax relief proposal wasn't entirely accurate, nor was the House's. And so the tax relief figures are being worked out. And once there's a consensus on that, then they can go in and finalize the budget. And so there's a fair amount of work to be done. This, in some ways, is not unusual. That is beyond the beginning of the fiscal year. And some people use that saying, this isn't unusual. It's a little later this year, but no big deal. I think it is a big deal. I think we should have our budget in place for July 1st. We're one of the few states that has not done that, and one of the few states that consistently is late. And so I think as a legislature, we have to look at the process we use, and we have to look at relationships at the leadership level between the House and Senate, and come together and work on behalf of the citizens of the Commonwealth. There are school systems that are worrying about what the status is going to be on their ability to provide lunches to students. There are people who are seeking treatments, mental health, medical treatments that are funded in some ways by our state budget that are wondering what's going to happen. There are nursing homes that rely on our rate reimbursements. There are child care providers, YMCAs, and others who depend on our rate reimbursements to determine how many slots they have available for young people. And so parents are worried about what's going to happen in September if those things aren't worked out. So across the wide range of our budget, it impacts so many people, and all of them right now are in limbo, and that's just not fair.
But I would believe that just in years past, the governor or some kind of piece of legislation, I believe like a 1/12th budget legislation that would at least cover the months, let's say if it does trickle into August, that there will be a funding mechanism for the state in an emergency capacity.
Yes, we passed a 1/12th budget for the month of July. You know, if some sort of agreement is not reached soon between the House and Senate, I suspect we will pass another 1/12th for August. But those are budgets that just kind of cover the basics.
Right.
To the extent that there was anything new in the budget or there's been a need for additional funding because of increases in costs, you know, many of those things, the those that are awaiting those funds are just really anxious about whether those needs will be met and when. And so, again, I think we've got to get to the point where we get beyond differences and get a budget in place.
Yeah, if you're just tuned in, we are speaking with State Senator John Keenan. We just had a couple of moments left with you, Senator, talking, you know, all business here. Let's talk a little bit. Have you had a chance to at least enjoy the warm weather? Have you had a chance to find your way in parts of your district to enjoy some of the great festivals or festivities that warmer months tend to bring about?
Yes, there's so much going on. It's great to see people out and about. There are concerts everywhere. Abington has its Sunday series. Braintree has concerts by the lake. Quincy's had a series of them. So all the towns in the area are doing those types of things, and it's great to get out and see people enjoying themselves. So yes, I have, and I'll continue to do that in the summer. I have to say the music selection's been pretty good. Mm. So that's great. And it's also a chance to get out and see people in a non-political setting and just to talk about, you know, how their summer's going, how their children may be. And then also it's a chance to see those with whom I work, you know, representatives, to see them out and about as well, outside of the state house. And I'm very fortunate to work with a great team. We talked about, for instance, the revenge porn bill. Representative Allison Sullivan of Abington has just been great on that bill. She's been such a strong advocate. So you get to see folks in a different setting, and that's really nice.
And if we could take a moment to shine a light on your staff, if folks wanted to reach out to your office if they felt as though that your office would be able to help them with certain situations, who should they reach out to, or how can they reach out to your staff?
I'm sure. So the best way. Well, there's a couple of ways. One is people can reach us by email, and that is john.keenan@masenate.gov. They can call us at 617-722-1494. And those are probably the two best ways. We have somebody who answers the phones every day, and calls go on to a list. We discuss them. I call folks back as quickly as possible. We have a system for responding to emails to make sure we address people's concerns. So reaching out to the office by email or a telephone are two of the best ways to do it.
Now, once you are able to pass the budget, now you get a little bit of downtime. Have you planned some excursions or ways to at least relax before the sessions start back up in the fall?
I have nothing planned other than to catch up on things that I should have been getting done over the last several months around the house. So I'll take some time to do that. And I find August, the first week of August is a period where we play catch up on a lot of things that you go unaddressed or that we can't get to during the last couple of weeks of July because of the busy schedule. And then the balance of August becomes a time of kind of regrouping and planning and getting things ready for September. So we'll be at the State House getting a lot of that work done, but it is a period of time where it's quieter, so I'm hopeful to get some time away, just not sure exactly when or where. I maybe just get my car and drive. Who knows?
There you go.
Hop on a train or a bus. We'll see.
Well, as always, I want to thank you for always being readily available whenever we want to have conversations or catch up on the latest news from Beacon Hill. And I hope you get a chance to get some good downtime.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I was just actually up in Quebec for a couple of days, and it was pretty exhausting. So I'm looking, it's very, very busy looking at hydrogen trains and whether they could be used here in Massachusetts and other transportation initiatives. So I'm looking forward to getting back on track here and then, yes, getting a little bit of time in August. So thank you, and I hope you have a great summer as well.
You got it. There he is, State Senator John Keenan, our guest for the first segment of Monday Night Talk. We will step aside. And when we come back, more Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
The Plymouth Sunrise Rotary presents a sanctioned wiffle ball tournament on Saturday, August 5th at 8 a.m. at Plymouth North High School. Five players per team. Anyone 15 plus is welcome. Sign up your team for $125. Proceeds from this event will go to the Johnny Hackett Memorial Fund, the John Santos Fund, and other organizations supported by the Plymouth Sunrise Rotary Club. Find out more and sign up your team. Go to Facebook, Rotary Sunrise of Plymouth. This message made possible by Tiny and Sons Glass. Sure, his boys do a good job, but can his boys hit a wiffle ball?
Invest your time in listening to Cape Retirement Radio and learn a smarter approach to investing so you can protect your future. Cape Retirement Radio, featuring Chris Letond, Thursday nights at 6:15 and Sunday mornings at 10 on 95.9 WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We return for more Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Joining us for this segment, we haven't had, it's been a bit, probably been a few months since we had the chairperson for the Hanson Board of Selectmen or Select Board. We have Laura Fitzgerald Kemet joining us. Madam Chairperson, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, Kevin.
So it's been, I think the last time we talked, it might have been prior to the town election in May. You know, the thought is you and I had discussed trying to stay in touch on a regular basis and talk about what's going on in the great community of Hanson. How are things on your end as far as the town goes?
Well, I think things are going pretty well. Of course, there's always concerns. We won't call them problems, but concerns and matters that need to be addressed. But I think we've got a very good board. With this last election, I was reelected, and we had a new member join us, David George. And he is a retired state police officer. He's really engaged, very, very, very involved with the American Legion in town and in general, and interesting and good guys. So he's come in ready to do the job, and then he's joining Ann Rain, who joined us last year, and Ed Hill, who joined us last year, and then Joe Weeks, who's been on for a bit.
So the last time you and I talked, I know town meeting had come and gone. I know one of the things that's usually a topic of conversation is, how can the town improve when it comes to building, when it comes to some of the land around town? And we were talking off mic for a few moments before joining the show. And one of the things that you had apprised me to is that the McQuant School is in the process of being raised at this particular time. What's the latest once that has been torn down? Is there a conversation as to what should happen to that property?
That's absolutely the conversation, and we're inviting everybody to join us in that conversation. So that piece of property is such a critical location. It's right next to our library and senior center, and it's right next to the Indian Head School, right? So that's a really critical piece of property. None of the boards that have been dealing with the use of that McQuant property have ever wanted to sell that property because of the proximity to those very important services and buildings. And never again will we ever have an opportunity to have a piece of property that is nearly all uplands, that is in close proximity to the senior center, library, and the school. And for town planning purposes, it really wouldn't be prudent for us to even entertain selling it. So one of the things that we're looking at, we've, of course, had many groups come to us and say, we've got needs. One of them is the library. They've had a study done that's showing that they're significantly undersized. And you can see that they're excellent people. They do an excellent job with the space that they have, as do the senior center folks, Mary Collins and Karen Stolfer in the library. They make it look seamless, and they do a great job with the limited space. But, you know, our seniors deserve better, and the town deserves better in terms of a space for the library. So those are some folks that might, you know, be doing something with that space. And also We've had a lot of the sports groups express some interest in potentially having fields there. So we've got a Mequon property reuse committee. We didn't want to create another committee, but there's really no other way of getting, you know, solving this riddle without that. And we are entertaining applications. We would love people to go on to our website under volunteer opportunities and apply to be part of that solution. If you've got ideas, we'd love to hear them. And not necessarily on Facebook, because that doesn't really effectuate any change. But being in person on that committee, you can effectuate some change and help shape what we do with that property.
I have to admit that this is a little bit of deja vu, because I believe the community, the town, had to do this recently, in the recent history, with the county hospital. Am I correct?
Correct. That is correct. The thing with these pieces of property, Kevin, is, you know, the town will decide to hold on to it, but we want to make sure there's such unique opportunities when they come up that you want to make sure, are we going to be able to service as many people in town as possible with this piece of property? We don't want to just cater to one group or another or whatever, some group, small group constituency. We really have to think about the future. So I think the tact that the board has historically taken with that property and other properties is the same tact we're going to take with Mequon, which is, you know, get that committee together, get the committee to make a presentation to the select board, get it before the voters. At the end of the day, right, we're always going to have the voters deciding ultimately on what's done with these pieces of property.
Let's talk a little bit about Main Street. I know that whenever there are political forums or when folks are running for office, one of the things that are brought up, one of the topics brought up is Main Street. A lot of activity on Main Street, a new development. I think that right now it's in the middle of being repaved. Can we talk a little bit about, let's talk about that part of town.
We've got all kinds of stuff going on Main Street, some of which is driven by private individuals and some of which has been driven by our town planner. So we've got the Steve Egan property that's the former Whole Scoop. Beautiful Victorian. People were very upset about that building being torn down, and I understand, because that building was a beauty, and I admired it as well. Unfortunately, I think Mr. Egan found that it was just going to be cost prohibitive to even try to reuse that. And that typically is the case a lot of times with older buildings when you're getting into construction. So he did offer to people to come and take things if they wanted to from the building, you know, if the historic commission wanted to or what have you. But that's going to be mixed commercial and residential. And we're thrilled to have it there. I think that it starts a domino effect along that Main Street. You're also seeing the former liquor store is going to be four condos, which Mr. Rosen is going to be working on. So I think that's going to be some very positive movement. You've also seen the dilapidated fire garage that we had there was taken down. So again, forward movement there. There do remain some buildings that are going to need to be addressed, and we are very focused on enforcement on those buildings to make sure that people are doing what they need to do so that the people that are tenants in those buildings are safe and so that our first responders are safe when they arrive if there's ever an issue. We're also seeing the gentleman who owns Spiro's. He has built a little convenience store next door, and that building has been at various things over the years, but nothing's really stuck. So it's going to be great to see that. I think he's going to have a good business model there with some of the other buildings that are going up with condos and what have you. He'll have a lot of foot traffic and folks from the T. So we've got that going on. And then we've had our town planner working on a series of grants for some sidewalks, some lighting, a boardwalk to connect us to Burrage. So we've got a lot of those irons are in the fire. We haven't heard yet whether we've gotten the grant money for any of those. And then Jameson Shav, our highway director, worked with the state, and the state is coming in at no additional cost to the town of Hanson in using millings along the road there. So although it's a little bit of a pain in the neck in the short term, in the long term, I think we will find ourselves not cringing as much as we perhaps used to driving through that section of town.
Again, if you are just tuning in, we are speaking with the chairperson for the Hanson Select Board, Laura Fitzgerald. Kevin is our guest, and we are doing State of Affairs with the great town of Hanson, Massachusetts. Kind of staying on development and properties. A piece of property that was donated to the town deciding to take it, the light control property. What's the latest with that? My thought was, my understanding was, that that would eventually become a new highway department barn or property. Is that still the case, or has that changed?
Yeah, it's still a, I'd say the ball is somewhat in motion, but on the way to landing on that. Our highway folks need a new building. We know that. I literally haven't heard anybody dispute that fact. And if anybody does want to dispute it, I would urge you to call Jamison Shav and visit the building, and any misconceptions you might have would be dispelled. So we know that they need to be put into safe conditions and conditions that we would all want to work in. Light Control was donated by Light Control / Hubble, who ended up becoming their parent company, quite a few years back. And initially, the thought process, although we never voted to make it a highway building, the thought process was perhaps because of the size of the buildings and the type of buildings, they're buildings that are very similar to what our highway guys are in now. Perhaps that would be a good location. There was a highway committee formed, highway building committee formed, because we don't do anything without a committee. You know, Kevin, you know that. So we had a committee. The last price tag I heard was that it was going to be $7 to $8.5 million, which seemed like a very large dollar amount, and certainly more than we, I think, had been led to believe, or most of us had thought it would be, based on the early discussions of accepting that gift. And since that time, our town planner has come back and said, I need to be honest with you as a planner. It's a little bit nuts to think about putting a highway building department on the very far side of the town. You're going to use all kinds of additional monies with salt and snow removal and the trucks, et cetera, if you're not centrally located. And he said, you know, just as a fundamental matter, as a planning matter, most highway buildings are centrally located. With that, and then also a letter from Mass Wildlife Fisheries telling us that they had serious concerns about a salt shed being located near the barge wildlife management area, it seemed like we sort of had, you know, kind of all of these compelling reasons why perhaps we needed to revisit whether that should, the highway building should be located there. The highway committee is going to make a presentation, but Ann Rain is chairing that, and she's already sort of told the board, look, we don't think that this is a good location for it. So she'll make the presentation, and then the board will decide. And then if we don't locate it there, we have to figure out what are we going to do with these buildings that have been gifted to us. We need to make use of them. There are some stipulations on those deeds that say you can't have a garden, you can't have a school, you can't. There's various things because it was the source of a DEP, you know, oversaw cleanup done by Hubble. As you can imagine, years and years and years of manufacturing, the ground was not untainted. But they were good stewards and did what they needed to do to clean up at least pieces of the property. We've got some questions about what remains on the property, to what extent the cleanup was done. And so we've applied for a grant to get somebody to come in and help us maneuver through those waters so we can figure out how to put that property to use. So that's what's going on with that.
I would ask you, let's talk a little bit about business. How is, knowing that we're, what, maybe about a year and a half removed from COVID, have the businesses in Hanson been able to bounce back, or have you lost an amount of business that you're hoping that one day you'll be able to replace what you've lost during the 2.5-3 years?
I would say the majority of our business, as you know, we're like 99% residential, right? So that 1% that we've had as businesses, the Walker Clays and Sullivan and Presidential Titanium, they're still hanging in and they're still doing well. you know, it's hard to measure how some of those, you know, home businesses may or may not have done because we don't really have any insight into that. But I'd say for the most part, the brick and mortar businesses have done pretty well. We've had some new businesses join us. We've had other businesses expand. So, you know, so I'd say it's fairly healthy. The Economic Development Committee is really working on trying to engage local businesses. So a letter is being sent out in the next week or so saying, hey, we have an economic development committee and we want to help you. And if you're thinking of expanding your business, talk to us because we may have an ability to defer taxes for you so that you can afford to invest more in the build-out. We may have other resources for you, so reach out to us. So we're very interested in that. We've got a good committee that's working on that.
Probably one of the final things I will ask you about, and that is it seems as though a lot of the important town departments in and around the South Shore, we're seeing a little bit of a changing of the guard, whether it's a new police chief or a new fire chief. I believe that a new fire chief has been sworn in the town of Hanson.
That is correct, Kevin. We're so fortunate. You know, we've got a lot of great people that have come up through the ranks in both fire and police. And we were really fortunate that our former fire chief, Jerry Thompson, really groomed and helped prepare us for his departure by having our deputy chief. And so we've now got Robbie O'Brien. And when, you know, Jerry was a hometown son, and Robbie is as well, you know, both have had their families here and lived here, and Robbie is just extremely enthusiastic about this job. We're thrilled to have him. The department's thrilled to have him. As a result of his promotion, a couple of other folks in the department were able to get promoted. He's very interested in engaging people in areas that they're interested in. So there's a gentleman who's really into kind of IT and social media. So he's sort of the firefighter's IT and social media person. He's found ways to really connect with people. He's an advocate for his staff. I'm really looking forward to what he can do. He's already hitting it out of the ballpark just in the first couple of months.
Again, we are speaking with Laura Fitzgerald Kemet. She is our guest. She is the chairperson for the Hanson Select Board of Selectmen. As we're wrapping up here, anything that we haven't touched upon, but you want to take a moment to remind either the listeners or the folks from Hanson who are tuned in?
No, not really. I will say Cranberry Cove is open for business, for residents and non-residents. You can check out our website. I want to give, kudos to the Camp Kewaunee Commission, to Frank Melissi, to Roger Means, and Dory Jameson and Renee Brown, who are up there every day, all day, making things happen behind the scenes, and it really shows. I was just up there today, and I've always loved Camp Kewaunee, but I couldn't love it anymore. It's looking great, and we welcome folks to come and use the beach.
Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us for this particular segment here on Monday Night Talk.
Thank you, Kevin.
You got it. We are going to step aside. That's it. Hour number one in the books, straight ahead. Hour number two, stay tuned for my Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
The Marshfield Cultural Council presents the Summer 2023 Sunday Evening Concert and Entertainment Series, Ben Rudnick and Friends, at 6 p.m. on July 30th at the Town Green. This is a family-friendly event that can be enjoyed by people of all ages. Bring a beach chair, blanket, or yoga mat, pack a picnic or snack, or enjoy tasty food from the on-site food truck, CJ's Creation Station. For more information, check the Marshfield Facebook page or call 781-834-2582. We hope to see you there. Support the Friends of the Plymouth Council on Aging Center for Active Living with the Super Summer Raffle. Tickets are on sale now. For just $100, you can win a fabulous cash prize of either $3,000 for first place, $1,000 for second place, and two chances at $500 for third place. Drawing will be held on October 2nd, but hurry up because there are only 100 slots available. For more information, please call 978-808-3895. We wish you the best of luck.
On Saturday, July 29th, Daniel Webster Masonic Lodge in Marshfield will be holding an open house and cookout for parents and their sons to come by and learn about DMLA International. We're located at 420 Furnace Street in Marshfield and will be there from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. For over 100 years, DMLA has been the premier organization based on timeless principles committed to developing and inspiring leadership, team building, and networking for young men ages 12 to 21. Don't miss this event to find out how joining DMLA can give your son an advantage and set them on their path to a bright future. The road begins here.
Looking for a fun, youth-filled South Shore musical before our high schoolers head to college? Come see Grease by Hingham Civic Music Theater, opening Friday, August 4th, for four performances at Hingham Town Hall's Sanborn Auditorium. The hit show is directed by Nathan Fogg. Shows start at 7:30 the first Friday and Saturday night, with an August 12th Saturday night show followed by a closing 2 p.m. Sunday matinee. Advance tickets at hcmt.org. Come enjoy Grease in Hingham's Town Hall Theater.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
We return our number two of Monday Night Talk. My name is Kevin Tachi, and I hope you've enjoyed the first hour. Our number two, we have a chance to speak with a gentleman who is on the Whitman Board of Selectmen. His name is Justin Evans. It's been a while since we have had Mr. Evans on, I think, and it's been a while since we had somebody on from the Board of Selectmen. I think previously, earlier this year, we had Randy Lamatina joining us, giving us a little bit of a tease as to what's coming up with town meeting and the town election. I think probably the biggest scoop in our conversation today will be about Peaceful Meadows.
I like the pun there.
You like the pun? We're full of puns today. But first, to catch up with you,
sure.
How are things in the great town of Whitman?
Things in Whitman are going well. As you kind of alluded to, we had a town election where our former chair, Randy Lamatina, was unsuccessful. We now have a new face on the board. Laura Howe, who has run before and has worked for the town for a number of years, is the newest select person. And Carl Kowalski has resumed his previous role as chair. So everything's, I guess, come back around.
You might be burying the lead, but I think the biggest piece of news, knowing that the town over the past 12, 15 years has built a new police station, did renovations to the fire station, mm-hmm. renovations to town hall, which is older than a century, right? Was yep. it, if I do a little dirty math, it was 2000. It was, when was it?
I think we,
2007 was, it's somewhere around there. Was its 100th anniversary, right?
Something like that. Early 1900s.
Early 1900s. So you did a lot of renovations to it.
Yep. At town meeting this year, we approved the new DPW building, another century-old building that's ready to be replaced.
But the key, you know what, it's passed previously in town meeting. People are like, yeah, when you see all the faces in town meeting, yeah, I want it. It's where when people go to the ballot box during the town election,
yep.
that it had been shot down in various forms.
Yes, and this time it was successful by a fair margin. I thought that was going to be a closer election, and I was a little surprised at the other ballot question. The selectmen had asked to make the treasurer collector an appointed position instead of an elected position, right. And the townspeople rejected that.
You're talking a $50 million business called the town of Whitman, right?
Yep.
I mean, I might be a few million off here, but you're talking about you want to put somebody, you know, behind, you know, with the books and managing the money and making sure that they're collecting taxes, they're sending out the tax bills. You want to make sure that you have somebody who, not to say that you have, that the town of Whitman hasn't had success with Mary Beth Carter.
Yeah.
Done a fantastic job.
I mean, she's now our town administrator. So it certainly proves that the townspeople have elected excellent treasurer collectors in the past. And they did elect Ken Lytle to be the permanent elected treasurer. I guess the elected treasurer collector. He was previously appointed to finish the vacancy created by the departure of Mary Beth. But I believe after the recount, it was 8 votes that changed the decision whether or not to make the treasurer collector appointed versus elected. Ken was elected to a 3-year term, and in 3 years he'll have to run again.
It's part of the process, right?
Yep.
But going back to the DPW building, yes. Knowing that it's the DPW, and you know what? It's every community is different. I've had a chance to on the South Shore see some of the best Department of Public Works, and Whitman is one of the best. And it's one of those interesting things. All four seasons, they're out there in the summer months like now, making sure that the parks, all the properties that the town have, look their best. Wintertime, when it comes to plowing, making sure the snow is cleared, the sidewalks are clear. It's interesting when you go from one community into Whitman that sometimes is like a lot of snow on those. And I'm not naming names. We're not here to out anybody.
Yep.
But you go from one small community into a bigger community, and their roads are barely plowed, and you're like, wow.
Yeah, no, Whitman's DPW does an excellent job. Between park and highway and water sewer, we are, I think, among the best in the South Shore, as you alluded to with plowing the snow. But also, we've been replacing sidewalks at a pretty amazing pace the last couple of years. Like, that's the biggest turnaround we've seen under the park and highway division. And they've been doing it all out of a 100-year-old building. So keeping all of the new equipment we've been purchasing year after year in that same old garage, it's time to have facilities that really meet the needs of the services we're providing.
Well, I think it's fantastic. The residents finally voted, and I'm sure that it was kind of a lot on the elected officials, the officials in the town, to make sure the best project was put forth this time. And I'm sure a lot of work was done behind the scenes to make sure that this was going to be something that was going to be a win-win, not only for the taxpayers, but also for the town itself.
Yeah, and a lot of credit goes to the DPW Building Committee, who put together just a fantastic project. And a lot of confidence, I think, came from the fact that, you know, we're currently completing a sewer force main project, a major replacement. And every step of the way, they continue to find new grant funding or eligible ARPA expenses or other ways to reduce the cost of that project. So, at least I stepped into the ballot box knowing that there's a good team behind it that is going to try to make this as cost-effective as possible, even if we are allowed to borrow up to a higher limit.
Again, we're speaking with Justin Evans. He is on the Board of Selectmen in the town of Whitman. Catching up with him as to some of the things that are going on in his community, and probably the biggest news as of late, and that is a community staple many, many years, many decades. Whether you liked going and seeing the cows or grabbing a scoop of ice cream or having a frap, word is at the end of August that the assets are going to be, the family's auctioning off those assets. Where were you? When did you learn that this was happening?
I found out a Friday night on Facebook, like I think everybody else did. Mm-hmm. And I was leaving for vacation the very next day. So, it hit me pretty quick, and I wasn't sure how to react. But it really is a loss. It's a staple of the town. Peaceful Meadows has been here for 60-plus years within the same family, operating a family-run ice cream parlor, dairy farm, where they, at least made the ice cream. And they had expanded to a Middleborough and a Plymouth location, so it was a great success for a Whitman family. In recent years, I think we've seen this. Looking in hindsight, you can see that it was coming. They sold the Middleborough building, I believe, last year. And I believe they are going to continue to operate the Plymouth facility, but without the dairy farm here, I'm not sure if they're going to change suppliers or how that's going to work. This is going to be a big loss for the community. I am hopeful that the way the auction is set up for the end of August, the commercial property is being sold as a separate parcel from the farm behind it, so hopefully another ice cream parlor decides to move in and the family can retire happily.
What's some of the information that you've been able to gather since the news came out that this property was up for sale? First off, how big of a parcel of land is this? Do we know?
So the The agricultural portion is 55 acres. And that has, you know, has a brook running along the back, a couple of marshes. So I'm not really sure how much of it's going to be buildable. I think that'll kind of work its way out as we start seeing bids. But there's that agricultural portion, plus there's a pretty large commercial portion. If you just think of the ice cream shop, the dairy store, the barn. And then across the street, they are also auctioning the two residential properties. So it's going to be big.
What's the best case scenario in regards to the sale? What is the worst case scenario? And this is just, I'm asking just you, the resident, the taxpayer. You don't necessarily have to put on the elected official hat, but I want to get your take on it as somebody who cares about this community, has worked hard for its betterment.
I mean, I think the best case scenario is someone chooses to continue to operate the business, purchase the farm, the ice cream parlor, and it just essentially changes hands. I'm not sure. I think worst case scenario, we'll see. I don't know. A lot of the different opportunities here for economic development, it could go any which way. I know that I personally have been kind of researching what happens if it is sold to no longer be a farm, if the agricultural portion is sold to be developed into either residential or commercial property. And looking at other towns around us that have gone through similar changes, it triggers a couple of possibilities there. So that's kind of where my line of thinking has been going. So where this property has been taxed under or has been allowed some tax breaks under what's called 61A in state law, the town itself will get a right of first refusal to match the winning bid if it were sold to no longer operate as a farm. And so you've seen that in a couple of in recent decades with the Griffin Dairy Farm in Abington or the McCarthy Farm in Rockland, where the town intervened and chose to purchase the property for, you know, Rockland or Abington for themselves. So that's kind of where I've been looking. I want to keep all options open, knowing that if someone were to come in and purchase the property at several million dollars, we probably can't afford to match that, knowing that, you know, we've got an operating budget of about $40 million, a little north of that, and, you know, taking ratepayer funds aside for water sewer probably pushes it closer to 50. But we can't necessarily pony up that kind of money. But if the auction were to come in the, you know, $1 million range, which is roughly what Griffin Dairy Farm sold for in Rockland, I think it's a 30-ish, 40-acre parcel, something similar, then the town could consider, you know, we would have 120 days from the purchase and sale agreement date to act. And luckily, we have a special town meeting to approve a potential middle school project in that window. So the residents of Whitman could choose to purchase this property if it were to be sold to no longer operate as a farm.
Would it be best if it was converted into, it was zoned commercially for businesses? Do you feel that businesses, Route 18, you know, you look at amenities, it's a main thoroughway. It isn't like it's landlocked like other communities where you don't have a main thoroughway going through. It's right on Route 18. It could it be attractive for a business that may look to relocate to Whitman?
I think it would certainly be attractive. I know it's one of those things that it would hurt me to build something on what is one of the largest open space parcels in Whitman. But just from a highway business perspective, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. If you look at some of the recent building that's been going up on Route 18, something there would match the aesthetic and would not necessarily look out of place.
Because I think of like Plimpton, and when they were able to lure Cisco from Norton, you know, I don't know how that's working out to this day, but the thought was is that they were going to gain some significant tax revenue. And that's, you know, in order to be able to keep up with the municipal, you know, the police and fire department contracts and make sure you're offering the best in public safety and being able to have, you know, a full crew when it comes to DPW to take care of the community. I mean, these are the things. And let's not forget, every year, annually, education is a key component that there's a lot of discussion. What can we give annually when it comes to the assessment for a regional school district?
Yeah, and actually education has been getting more expensive the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
And Whitman-Hanson is in kind of the unique position where with declining enrollment, the state formula keeps telling us that we need less money for education, but the actual cost of education is not going down. So something that were to draw, if it were a, you know, if we were to build more housing in Whitman, that could potentially alleviate that. But then the question becomes, is this the right place to build housing when, you know, at least my intent is for the town to comply with the MBTA communities law and build more residential housing near the train station where, you know, aesthetically would fit in more than within the highway business district and in the last parcel of open space. So it's, there's a lot of possibilities here that are going to unfold, you know, in the next 2 months.
Now, is that transit ruling as far as making sure you have sufficient housing around the commuter rail? Where is, do you know where Whitman is in compliance to that? Is that 3A?
That's 3A. So yep. The Whitman completed our initial sort of compliance letter to the state saying this is how we intend to comply with the law. This is our sort of proposed path. And just recently we received a grant to sort of rewrite our zoning in the area of the train station and likely the center of town to comply. So sometime probably at the May town meeting in 2024, there will be a zoning bylaw amendment put forward to fully comply with this. So I think Whitman right now is well on its way to compliance. I know you've seen some communities in the area intending not to comply. Middleborough's been
pushing back. They want to fight it.
And I'm interested to see how that plays out because under the previous governor, under Governor Baker, it seemed like it was just a, you know, carrot stick situation. You won't be eligible for these grants if you don't comply.
It's a little bit more rigid now under this administration?
Yeah, the current attorney general has made it a little bit more, you know, this is a state law and you will be complying with it. So I'm interested to see kind of how the towns that are choosing not to comply play out. I think that may influence the town meeting vote come May.
The other thing that I think of always when it comes to federal mandates, when it comes to housing, affordable housing, anti-snob law, where does Whitman stand? I'm not sure if you know because I'm just throwing this at you. I mean, are they close to compliance? Are they close to 10% of what the housing stock is? Or is it a, because I know it's always a fluid situation.
Yeah, so Whitman has a draft housing production plan. It's a little dated now, but in about 2020, the last time we looked at the numbers, we had between 3 and 4% of our housing stock was considered affordable by whatever metric the state uses for that. So we are still quite a ways away from that 10% goal. And as I'm sure you know, that means that a 40B project could come into Whitman, potentially purchase that property that's going up for auction, and sort of overrule local zoning should the Board of Selectmen choose not to exercise the right of first refusal and present it to town meeting to for the money to purchase it.
You and I, before the microphones were hot, we kind of teased in the thought that if Whitman did decide to, if it was affordable to buy the property, that there might be a caveat. I think it's been the past couple of years that you were collecting, the community's been collecting CPC money, right?
We have. That passed in the presidential election of 2020, and shortly thereafter we started collecting community preservation revenues. This past May town meeting was the first time we funded any projects, and it was handicapped accessible benches for the park. So that was the very first expense for community preservation funds in Whitman. And now I am very thankful that we passed it, because if we exercise the right of first refusal and the town chose to purchase the property, that's a potential source of revenue. Just kind of ballpark numbers, I think we have about $250,000 in eligible funds between both the general purpose CPC funds and the open space funds to potentially spend on acquiring open space. CPC also has kind of a unique caveat where you can bond the project against future CPC revenue. So if, you know, again, this would all be up to town meeting and the Community Preservation Committee, but if Whitman were to choose to bond $1 million just for a number, we could pay that back over about 5 years with our annual CPC revenue.
Again, if you're just tuning in, we have Justin Evans. He is on the Whitman Board of Selectmen. We're talking about everything Whitman, even talking a little bit about the possible demise of Peaceful Meadows as it's up for auction the end of August. So you mentioned you've teased about building a new middle school. I think that last week you actually got your committee that is looking to build this, discussing it, new renderings.
We did, and it looks fantastic. I'm really excited to see sort of how you can rethink that property up on Corthell Ave. So the design right now has sort of what we did with the high school, knock down the existing building, build fields there, and build the current, the new building on what are the athletic fields behind it. So you do sort of a flip. But the way that that opens up the property so that there's you turn around that corner and just see open fields and then the building, and then from the building look out and see athletic fields, it's just it completely rethinks the middle school and all of the, you know, softball fields, soccer fields, everything around it.
How much work has gone into discussing this new building and this new school for the community?
This has been a very long project. I think we authorized
a couple of years.
Yeah, 2018, 2019 was the initial.
And then we had COVID.
Then we had COVID. I'm actually not the first selectman to serve in this committee. Randy LaMattina was the selectman representing the town on the committee, and I was just appointed to this in the last couple of months to replace him. So I'm coming up to speed real quick, but it's hitting kind of right in my wheelhouse as we're talking about energy use and some of that stuff.
Yeah, and it's so funny is you and I talking. I didn't even realize that you're an EV owner. You have a electric vehicle.
I do.
What's that like?
Oh, I love it. It is the best car I've ever driven, not even owned. It is nothing this big has any reason to be that fast.
Yeah, you got to pick. It's a
Rivian. Rivian R1T. It's a electric pickup truck. I've had it for about a year, and apart from a couple of quirks when you're driving long distances, need to find the appropriate charger that's working as advertised. That's the only problem I've had with it. I've had to do one tire rotation is the only maintenance so far. I'll be replacing the wiper blade soon. But I'm with the regenerative braking, I'm expecting the brakes to outlast the body of the vehicle.
Wow.
It's great.
Now, how many miles have you put on it so far? And what's the distances? I mean, do you travel long enough distances? Your conventional fossil fuel vehicle will go anywhere between 3 to 450 miles on a tank. Will an EV do the same thing?
So I've driven about 14,000 miles on this car right now in about a year. I drive quite a bit. And on a full charge, it's got different operating modes. So if I turn off four-wheel drive and kind of reduce the amount of throttle you're able to give it, I can get 350 miles on a single charge. In the winter, that gets cut a little bit as you need to use electric resistance heating to keep the cabin warm. There's no more heat coming off of the engine. But in four-wheel drive, pedal to the metal, do whatever you want mode, I can still get over 300 miles on a single charge.
Wow.
And so I wake up, almost every day with one of the quirks about electric vehicles and lithium-ion batteries is you don't want to fully charge and fully deplete all the time. So I usually charge to 75, 80%. Every day, if I drive less than 250 miles in a day, I'm good to go.
I think we've touched upon everything during our brief stint here behind the microphone together. Wrapping up where we originally started, and that is talking a little bit about Peaceful Meadows. Favorite memory of Peaceful Meadows, whether your family, what are you going to remember most about it? Hopefully the memories will keep continuing depending on who purchases the property.
I would love to see that continue. My wife and I have had a debate for a number of years. She grew up in Hanson and was a Heidi's Hollow fan. Yeah. And I've always been a Peaceful Meadows guy. So, I think, even a couple of weeks ago, we picked up a Sunday pack for my mom's birthday. It's just such an integral part of the community. I think my favorite memory is growing up after, soccer games, going there with the team or with my family and just, watching the cows while you eat ice cream. It's just such a unique thing that you don't find everywhere.
That is true. And knowing that it's like a part of Americana, especially, a lot of times you find stuff like that in the Midwest. It's very rare that, in an area like this that you would see that. But it's, you want to keep those little rare gems like Peaceful Meadows. Unfortunately, they're just, memories now, at least for the foreseeable future, unless we have more information.
Yeah, and I would love to see another ice cream shop move in there just so that Whitman doesn't lose that sort of essential piece of Americana. But I do wish the family well. They've definitely earned this retirement, run it through a couple of generations for a real stable of the community. So,
was there nobody in the family that wanted to continue the tradition? It's just kind of like, the next generation is like, it's not something I want to do.
I haven't spoken to them, but at least what I'm hearing is that they intend to continue to operate the Plymouth store. So they may want to continue to operate an ice cream parlor, but not a farm.
Definitely interesting. Now, what's your flavor choice? Do you have a flavor or flavors?
I'm very boring. I'm a vanilla frap guy. You'll occasionally venture off and get some M&M or Oreo, but usually it's just a vanilla frap.
I mean, they always have. I used to love seeing the different specialties or eggnog, whatever. They would offer such a variety, and it would be year-round, and that's kind of sad. And I know that it's been something that's been bemoaned by the South Shore Morning News radio host, Rob Hacklett. It's also funny, is it sometimes for Christmas, because he's a big ice cream guy, I've bought him, you know, Peaceful Meadows gift cards. I'm like, you better get on it. You better start using those, or they're just going to be, you know, mementos.
I know. Yeah, it's tough. It's been, yeah, such a big part of Whitman for generations. If you think about my current board of selectmen, we span a couple of generations, and almost all of us have fond memories of going there as children.
So sure,
it's going to be tough.
Probably the last thing I would ask you, again, we teased the middle school. Is that going to be something that's going to be coming up this fall at town meeting? And that's something that maybe residents, even though they're still enjoying the full throes of summer, that come this fall, that is going to be a town meeting to talk about the middle school, at least getting monies to build it.
Yes. Thanks for asking. So Whitman does not usually have a fall town meeting, but this year we will have an October 30th special town meeting to consider at least this article and potentially the use of CPC funds or other revenues to purchase to exercise the right of first refusal to purchase Peaceful Meadows.
Something to keep an eye on. Well, Justin, I want to thank you. Anything you want to say as we wrap up this segment?
No, it's great to be back. Thanks for inviting me.
You got it. There he is, Justin Evans. He is on the Whitman Board of Selectmen talking sadly about the Peaceful Meadows and our memories. We are going to step aside one final segment of Monday Night Talk. Fear not, more conversation ahead. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Don't go without a primary care physician. Signature Healthcare is here to support you. There are so many reasons to choose Signature Healthcare for primary and specialty care for you and your family. Signature Healthcare provides trusted referrals to over 17 signature medical specialties and direct access through their medical affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. You'll have access to their retail pharmacy and urgent care centers, providing you full access to your medical records and the ability to request medication refills through their secure patient portal. Most of all, Signature Healthcare helps you stay on top of your health through regular checkups by top quality physicians and staff. Start a relationship with Signature Healthcare today. For an appointment with a Signature Healthcare primary care physician, call 844-SHC-APPT. That's 844-742-2778. Or email APPTS@signature-healthcare.org. Find out more at signature-healthcare.org.
Are you worried about your drinking?
Or is someone else worried about your drinking?
Alcoholics Anonymous has a solution.
There is no shame in living with a disease called alcoholism.
Regardless of your age, employment, or any other circumstances in your life, you deserve help from other individuals who understand what you are going through. Alcoholics Anonymous is here for you 24/7 at AA.org. Find online meetings at AABoston.org.
She was buried in a Provincetown grave with no name for almost 50 years and was known as the Lady in the Dunes. Now we know her as Ruth Marie Terry. Join me for a special report on Wednesday morning right after the 7:30, 9 a.m. and noon news and learn more about some of the people who worked to help solve the mystery of her identity. Christine James, WATD News.
Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
And we've come to the final segment of Monday Night Talk. No, it's not a sad affair. If anything, it's a way for you to be better informed and educated on a lot of things that are going on. We brought in one of our great legal minds, a gentleman who... he is someone who is a student of history and somebody who is, when it comes to certain parts of law and rulings, he's very succinct with giving his insight on the particular conversations. We've actually featured him multiple times for various reasons. I'm talking about the one and only Chris DiOrio, who is joining us. Chris, how are you today, sir?
Good evening, Kevin. Doing fine.
So so our conversation, you and I had kind of picked out the topics. It's a little bit more than a year since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade.
Right.
Also, there was a recent mistrial of a gentleman named Emmanuel Lopes, accused of killing the Weymouth Police Sergeant Michael Chasda and bystander Vera Adams. Yep. And then another interesting piece, and that is the 303 Creative versus LNS. And this I think this was one of the topics that you had mentioned, because you see this as a possible door opener for future limits in lawsuits. So we have quite the menu of topics to talk about, and at least kind of give folks some kind of an update, and also kind of get your insight, because I'm sure that these are things that people have asked you about, or that you have had a chance to kind of look at and kind of say, how can this go? Because that's what attorneys, people like you do, correct?
That's the idea. That's the idea. I went in, part of my practice is teaching. Getting people to understand things not using so much jargon and language that makes people's eyes glaze over and sort of fade out. It's important that people understand, especially when you're dealing with your rights to certain individual rights that are important, that you need to know where the lines are, and they seem to be constantly shifting these days. So it's important to know where they are right now,
right,
and where they're going.
Right. And again, you're somebody who I think you're a big fan of constitutional law, a gentleman who, on any given day, depending on the year and the time, handing out constitutions.
Over 10,000 of them at this point. Yeah.
And I'm one of those people who got one. I'm receiving, actually personally delivered it to me. So, so we could be better informed and understand the laws and the laws of our land, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Let's again, when this broke a year ago, you were the first person I reached out to and said, "Hey, can we have a conversation about this?" And you said, "Absolutely." Roe versus Wade. This was a landmark decision by the Supreme Court, in which the court ruled that the Constitution of the United States generally protected a right to have an abortion. And so since that landmark ruling in 1973, in 2022, the Supreme Court decided to overturn it.
It almost made it to 50. But since the Roe decision was handed down in 73, from that point going forward for the next 49 plus years, states and courts had been chipping away. The original notion in Roe, creating a trimester system justifying or allowing a person to be able to seek an abortion, that within the first 3 months there's no restrictions, and then in the second 3 months there would be some restrictions allowed, but and then in the third, states could outright ban it. In the last 3 months of pregnancy, they could simply say no. After that, there was the case of Casey versus Planned Parenthood in Pennsylvania, which sort of changed that trimester framework and created what was referred to as the undue burden system, that states could pass laws unless those laws created an undue burden on the affirmed constitutional right for a woman or a person, having a child to seek to abort that child. And that was from, the early 90s, a Sandra Day O'Connor decision, by the way. So since that point and that undue burden system, there have been a number of cases that came down. And this last one, this most recent one that we're talking about, Dobbs, had laws put in place in Mississippi that would, restrict abortion after 6 weeks, and just an outright ban, no coverage or protections for life of the mother, no, you know, protections, you know, for pregnancies caused by rape or incest, just an outright 6-week ban. If you talk to anybody who has ever had, you know, the privilege or pleasure of giving birth or having a child, most times they'll tell you they don't know until after 6 weeks. So there are a number of people out there who might find out that they're pregnant, you know, 7-8 weeks later, and under this Mississippi law, you're out. You're stuck now. You cannot legally get this child. You cannot abort this fetus in the state of Mississippi. And the Dobbs decision came down last year in a sort of a mixed court decision. It shows up if you look at it as a 6-3 decision, 9 members on the Supreme Court, 6 of them voted to strike down Roe. Chief Justice Roberts kind of hedged. If you look at it in reality, it's actually a 5-4 decision or a 5-3-1, because Roberts hedged his bets a little bit and said that while he agrees that the law needed to change and that Roe needed to be overturned, it didn't need to be overturned as drastically as Justice Alito did, and opened up the door to the possibility of going after other individual rights that had been gleaned out of the Supreme Court over the course of the last 150 years regarding what's referred to as substantive due process, you know, the rights that we, you know, share and enjoy to, you know, freedom to marry, freedom of speech, anything of that nature that the court created, they now have left open. So the legacy of Dobbs now, 1 year later, is there have been 14 separate states that have immediately banned abortion entirely. Some of them by means of what were referred to as trigger bans, states that actually had laws placed on the books that said, if Roe were ever to be overturned, this law immediately takes effect. Mm. So they passed a law hoping or preparing for Roe to be overturned. And then once it was, the trigger, in essence, was pulled, and these laws were enacted, Oklahoma being one of them. Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana all had trigger bans just waiting. So there are 14 states now that have, based on the overturning of Roe, outright banned abortions entirely, and some of them have actually criminalized abortions. 10 other states are now what are considered hostile to abortions. That have laws in place that severely restrict where someone can go, who can, you know, who can engage in the practice, punishing anybody who's providing these services. States like Wyoming, Utah, Arizona has a number of laws that are, you know, really place restrictions on this. As close as it gets to us here in Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, while the governor there is a pro-choice governor, the legislature in Pennsylvania is now controlled in both houses by the Republican Party, and they are seeking to try to pass an outright ban or restrictions on abortion there. But that's as close as it gets to us in terms of outright hostility towards the right to terminate a pregnancy. And then there are 3 other states that, while they don't outright ban abortion now, there are no laws on the books that protect a person's right to do that. And one of those states is our neighbor to the north, New Hampshire. While abortion is still accessible in New Hampshire, there is no legal protection for it. There is no legal right to it. There's nothing asserted in the state's constitution or in the state's law that says that it is a right that is protected. There. So while you still have access, New Hampshire is not considered a hostile state to it, but it is certainly a state that, for want of a better term, is in play.
As you mentioned and talk about, you know, once this was overturned and that you had 14 states that had trigger bans, regardless of that, are we watching this political pendulum as it swings, that if it swings back and there is a change in what the political stature is of the folks on the Supreme Court. Is there a chance that this could be once again turned over? I mean, we know it took 49 years for this to be chipped away at and to be overturned. Is it, you know, do we wait another 10, 20 years for, you know, it to be overturned? And then how does that affect the state laws? I would think that your federal law is a lot greater than your state law. But, you know, if you have a little bit of a civil war and you have 15 states that are going to defect from the United States, well, that might be another story for another day. How can we talk a little bit about that as far as the political pendulum and, and what kind of an effect with the Supreme Court if in fact the numbers are swayed and changed through political, you know, through presidential appointments and them being accepted?
Well, this is, you know, again, and something that I've been talking about for over 30 years now, and I've instructed my wife to etch this on my gravestone when I ultimately pass. elections have consequences.
Yes.
We right now have, if there, you know, we have a Democrat in the White House, and we have the United States Senate, which is a slim Democratic majority, but you can't get things done at the federal level in terms of legislation to pass any significant federal legislation to do so. The other issue that you have to deal with, specifically with the executive and the president, is appointments to the Supreme Court. And right now, you know, with the current majority on the supermajority, for, you know, to want a better term, the younger, the most recent appointments by President Trump are all under the age of 60. And the lifespan of a justice on the Supreme Court has expanded beyond an average of 30 years. What that means is that a president can last in office no longer than 8 years. But if they appoint a young justice to the Supreme Court, or if they appoint young judges to the lower courts, to the appellate courts below, or to the federal district courts, where a lot of these cases are ultimately decided, because only, you know, less than 100 cases actually get heard by the United States Supreme Court every year. But there are thousands of cases that start. If you appoint these judges to the lower federal courts, they are there for life. Lifetime appointments are what, you know, is the great benefit of the federal judiciary. Once you get the job, you have it until you want to leave, or if you're impeached, and a federal judge hasn't been impeached for over 160 years, and that was because the judge was a habitual drunk who was accepting bribes to make decisions. And that was a long, long time ago. We don't see judges getting bounced out of their seats. The closest one historically to us would be Justice Abe Fortas back in the late 60s, who resigned rather than run the risk of being impeached. So that, you know, created an issue there, but it never actually happened. So what we would see now in your question would be related to appointments to the bench. And the justices that are currently making up the supermajority, Justice Thomas is in his early 70s, Justice Alito is heading towards 70, but given the history of justices on the court, that's another 10 to 15 years potentially for these justices to remain. And then you've got younger justices, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Coney Barrett on the court now, all in their late 40s, early 50s. That's another 30 years.
Wow.
They're not going anywhere. And you know, we see Justice Ginsburg passing and Justice Breyer retiring. They get replaced. You know, Justice Ginsburg gets replaced by her polar opposite in Amy Coney Barrett. But Justice Biden is allowed to replace Justice Breyer with Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Still, the balance of the court is imbalanced. It's a 6-3 majority for one side, and that side is decidedly anti-abortion. So, and if you look at the map, when you talk about how is this going to affect things long-term, the bulk of the states that are hostile to or have outright banned abortion are below the Mason-Dixon line, you know, with the exception of the southern parts of Illinois, all the way, you know, you can draw a line from Maryland all the way across to Utah. And pretty much every state below that line, with the exception of Colorado, is either hostile to or anti-abortion, and has criminalized it. It's an entire section of the country. Whereas the coasts are usually pretty good about it, at least in the Northeast and on the West Coast. So a decision from the Supreme Court is extremely unlikely unless there is a mass exodus of justices on the conservative wing of the Supreme Court. And that doesn't seem likely. We saw what Justice Breyer did. He wanted to hold on until there was a Democrat in the White House to replace him. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, held on, some might argue too long, and tried to hold on until there was a Democrat in the White House and didn't make it. So that's tremendously important politically is the power to appoint judges, because that is an echo that ripples out for decades after a president leaves office.
So we're more than halfway through our allotted time here. Is there anything that you foresee that we're going to be watching for in whether it's the coming months or the next year or two? If you could kind of briefly give me a synopsis and then we can move on to our next topic.
Regarding this particular area, what we're seeing now is a number of states, Roe having been, done, now a number of other states like Florida, like South Carolina, like Arizona, have now started passing or attempting to pass 6-week bans or longer bans that restrict a woman's right to choose to terminate her pregnancy. And what's happening is in those cases, lower courts are issuing injunctions to stop those laws from being put in place. And some of these lower courts are the decisions are being made by justices appointed by former President Trump. It's an odd thing that's happening. These laws are at the lower levels are being deemed to be too much. It's almost as if they're using that undue burden status still to determine whether or not these kinds of laws are too onerous. What we're going to see is a number of these cases passing through the courts over the course of the next couple of years to get back in front of the court, and either an appellate court above them will overturn the lower court's injunction, or they will find their way back to the Supreme Court. Basically, what the Supreme Court said last year was, we are leaving the decision as to whether a state is going to have the right to an abortion, the right to choose, we're going to leave that to the individual states. And then they decided not to and allowed a number of courts to go in and make decisions that were very much federal intrusion into the decision making process of states. That's where we're going to start to see the argument happen now. Is this going to be a number of are states going to start voting on this? And that's going to and what's going to happen with those elections? Are federal courts going to allow states to actually make decisions that might, in fact, be pro-choice?
Something that'll bear watching for sure. Let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about the recent mistrial of Emmanuel Lopes. This is an individual accused of killing Weymouth Police Sergeant Michael Chesna and bystander Vera Jane Vera Adams. Can we talk a little bit about? So this ended in a mistrial. The belief is that there was one juror who could not. There was something with some of whether it's the evidence. We're still flushing this out. As somebody who's been a defense attorney for more than three decades, if I'm correct, talk to me about both sides of this. If you're somebody who you're the prosecution, you set this up, and then if you are a defense attorney, what is your defense? They do not dispute, in fact, that Lopes had in fact committed this crime, but a matter of that he was experiencing mental issues during that time. He had experienced it and he was overcome with it, And if anything, it kind of took over his emotions. Kind of, have you been watching this? And what are your thoughts, if you could, in the simplest terms, give us your take on it.
Yeah, the issue here is one of criminal responsibility, and that's, you know, and that's on both sides. You know, whenever a prosecutor brings a case, specifically, you know, like this, you know, with murder charges, the prosecutor has the burden and the sole burden to prove that someone did it, but you also have to prove that they did the thing with the requisite intent to commit the crime.
Right.
You have to prove that the person who did this act did it with the knowing intent of the result that they were looking for, to end someone's life. And the burden is beyond a reasonable doubt. If the prosecution can't meet that burden, they can't be successful. By the same token, this criminal responsibility question is important because if a defendant raises the question of criminal responsibility, that they are not to be held liable because they lacked the capacity to either appreciate the criminality or wrongfulness of what they were doing, or that based on a mental defect or disorder that they were unable to conform their conduct to the requirements of the law. That's the either or. But the defense doesn't have to prove insanity. The defense doesn't have to prove lack of capacity. The prosecution still has the burden there to prove that they didn't act because of this mental illness or, you know, incapacity. Prosecution has the burden at all times, even when the defense raises this. And that's the issue here. The issue is raised that Mr. Lopes had a long history of mental illness, and that specifically during the time that they were engaged in the criminal act that resulted in the death of Officer Chesna and Ms. Adams, that, you know, he was acting in the middle of a psychotic or, you know, schizoid episode, and lacked the understanding to, you know, the girlfriend of Mr. Lopes testified about, he went off in a rage, but it, you know, like not just an angry rage, but like an unhinged psychotic kind of thing that started in the beginning of the day and lasted up until the time that the two deaths occurred. The prosecution has to disprove both of those elements in order to be successful. So they have to prove intent. And then if the defense raises the issue of capacity, they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did understand the criminality of what he was doing and that he wasn't, you know, unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of the conduct. It's a hard burden. It's tough. And in this particular case, it seems like one juror, if you believe that, I believe the foreperson of the jury actually spoke, and said that when they started their deliberations, they were split. It was kind of a 50-50 situation after the first day. But over the course of time, apparently they had winnowed it down to an 11-1, and the one person just didn't change their mind. They wouldn't be heard. Even after Judge Canone gave them what's referred to as an Allen charge. Judges don't like mistrials for a variety of reasons. Judicial economy being one, but judges don't like mistrials. You don't want to have to bring a case back and start it all over again from the beginning. There should be one jury that hears a case and one set of facts and one prosecution, and that's it. But the Allen charge is bringing the jurors out when they say that they're deadlocked and reminding them just how important this case is and reminding them what the cost would be to bring about a new prosecution and have to go get a new set of jurors and please go back. And if there's any possibility that you can, you know, reach a unanimous verdict, whatever it is, and judges don't know when jurors, you know, send out notes, they're not allowed to say, we're deadlocked at 8-4. We're deadlocked at 11-1. They don't get a count. The only count they get is either a guilty or a not guilty, because that indicates that all 12 have made one decision. It's the only count they ever get. So when judges get a note that says we're deadlocked, They don't know if it's just one holdout.
Right.
They could be two, could be five, could be whatever. They don't know, but they still have to give the same Allen charge to get the jury to move. And in this case, they just, if it's just one, they didn't get that one. And speaking strictly as a defense attorney right now, when I'm picking a jury, I'm hoping that I can get at least one strong voice in the room that will at least listen to the arguments that I'm going to make. So in my practice in New York, I was allowed to ask jurors directly, you know, questions, as opposed to here in Massachusetts where you, you know, you have to, you know, give the questions to the judge and the judge asks questions if right. they decide to allow it. But I would ask folks in the jury box, you know, look, what if you get this case and it's in your hands on a Friday afternoon and you've got tickets to the Yankee game and the Yankee game's at 7 o'clock and we're here at 5 o'clock and you're going to be sequestered and you're not going to be able to go anywhere. Are you still going to be able to hold on to your verdict, even with all the pressure from everybody else that wants to get out and enjoy the weekend and get on with their lives? Well, that's important.
Knowing that you're a theater guy and probably, I don't know if they've ever done a version of 12 Angry Men.
12 Angry Jurors, oh yeah.
Right? Now, wasn't one of them they were worried about getting the verdict done so they can go to a ball game?
Yeah, that was the Lee J. Cobb character. Yep, I think it was juror number five.
Yep, perfect.
Jack Warden.
Yep.
Zach Warden, he had a New York Giants cap on. Yep.
So, unfortunately, we've got less than a minute and a half left. So we're not going to get to the 303 Creative versus Alanis. But if you could, in a quick synopsis here, and you got like 60 seconds, the clock will be ticking. And that is if you are the prosecution, what are you changing when it comes to the retrial? And if you are the defense, Do you keep the same game plan, the same approach to defending this individual, Emmanuel Lopes?
It's rare in these situations that you're going to see any real change, and especially now with the prosecution understanding that it was just one. You might look at that as being an anomaly, and in the hopes that when you pick your new jury, that you're looking at all of these circumstances and you'll be able to get the 12 that you're looking for. By the same token with the defense, you know that you're able to put a chink in the armor a little bit. You might want to bolster the whole notion of your experts and things related to the lack of criminal responsibility. You want to make sure that that's out there, especially for appeal.
WATD-FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news.